Good afternoon. I'd like to welcome our members and guests to this 478th meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations. Since its founding more than 40 years ago, the forum has been hearing from an invited speaker each month on an issue central to U.S. foreign policy. This month, we are pleased to have Mr. Henry Haggard here to speak on the U.S.-Korea relationship in transition. Henry Haggard had a distinguished 25-year career with the State Department. He retired in June, I believe he told me, in June of 2024, as a member of the Senior Foreign Service and at the rank of counselor. Henry Haggard is the founding partner of Seekonk LLC, senior advisor at West Exec, non-resident fellow at the Baker Institute at Rice University, a senior associate at the Center for Security, Diplomacy, and Strategy at Vrije University, Brussels, and a U.S. senior advisor to the American Chamber of Commerce, Korea. Makes me tired just to read all of that. Certainly, he's not slowed down in his retirement. Mr. Haggard's final posting at the State Department was as Director for Energy Diplomacy, responsible for policy related to the Middle East and Asia. From 2021 to 2023, he was political counselor at the U.S. Embassy in Seoul, advising on South Korean politics and the U.S.-Korea bilateral security relationship. Immediately prior to that, he served at the White House as Director for European Affairs on the National Security Council. Between 2000 and 2020, Mr. Haggard worked in a variety of roles to advance U.S. foreign policy goals both at home and abroad. His service included assignments to the U.S. mission to the European Union, Iraq, France, and South Korea. Mr. Haggard is the founder of the 25-Year Apprenticeship, a resource for diplomatic tradecraft. He's a frequent contributor to news broadcasts and other media outlets covering the Korean Peninsula and global affairs. He holds a Bachelor of Arts degree in International Relations from Brown University and a Master of Arts in Strategic Studies from the U.S. Army War College. He speaks fluent French and Korean, and I know from speaking to him, he also speaks fluent English.
Yes.
Henry, welcome to the Midcoast Forum.
Thank you. Well, thank you so much, George. Thank you, all of you, for coming today. This is a real honor and pleasure to be invited up here to Maine, to have a chance to talk to all of you via Maine Public Radio after growing up many years ago in Maine, in Old Town, Maine. It's great to have this opportunity to share a little bit of some of my insights about what I did after I left Old Town. So thanks again for the chance to be here, and I'm really excited to be able to talk to you about the U.S.-Korea relationship. With the relationship right now is, I do believe this is an important year for both South Korea and the United States, for the relationship, for the very obvious reasons that the United States, we have a new administration, and South Korea, as you know, is in the midst of a political turmoil, and they'll have a new president almost certainly in the next few months. But before I look at this transition and how I think it's useful to, the factors I think it's useful to look at to kind of understand where this relationship is going, I think it's important to first just take a minute to kind of outline what South Korea is, what it has, what it represents, and what the relationship with the United States, how much it means, and then kind of look at, you know, where it could be going. So, you know, we all know, you know, South Korea is, you know, a powerhouse in semiconductors and cars, and, you know, it's a manufacturing country, but I think it's important to just point out it's a country of 50 million people, not that many, no natural resources other than the people themselves and what they've been able to do since, you know, just 70 years ago, the poorest country in the world after their civil war. They've come to the point where they are the leading foreign direct investor into the United States. In 2024, they outpaced the next country, Taiwan, by over 20%. So they're the 12th largest economy by GDP. They're a vibrant economy, but also culturally. We all know about their Oscar victories, their BTS, the Gangnam Style, all of the cultural phenomenon where Korea has taken, you know, a global role. And I think it's important to understand the economy, you know, the cultural role, but also the role that Korea plays in the United States with over 3 million Korean Americans, hundreds of thousands of Koreans studying at any given time in America, hundreds of thousands of more tourists. So Korea and Koreans and Korean companies and Korean money and investment have really reached all corners of our society, of our country. And that's, I think, an important framing to when you think about what the nature of our relationship and the potential for where it could be, both in a positive and a negative sense. Now, if you look at the relationship, the U.S.-Korea relationship, it started as a security relationship. We came to, over 36,000 of our soldiers died fighting for South Korea, with South Korea, and that was the basis and the fundament of the relationship for many decades, and still does serve as a foundation. The security relationship is at the foundation of how we work with South Korea. We still have 28,000 troops in South Korea, and we still are coordinating with them all the time on the full range of geostrategic regional security issues. But more now, of course, it's an economic relationship, it's an economic partnership. We have a free trade agreement with South Korea. They play a key role in helping us to shape our policy toward China. They play a key role in building our relations with Southeast Asia, Pacific Islands. A lot of work that we do in the government is working with South Korea and Japan particularly, but also, you know, Australia and New Zealand. They're working more and more together with us to advance security and prosperity. It comes down to that. And so I only go with this very broad background to kind of explain how central I think this relationship, which is therefore why it matters that we're talking about the transition, why we're talking about how this could evolve, why it matters, and maybe how we can even, in our conversations, how we can contribute toward maybe steering it in a little better direction. Because ultimately, I'm going to give away the punchline. As a longtime diplomat, I'm an optimist. I'm definitely voting for, pushing for the positive outcome here. But I will lay out, you know, kind of the best case scenario and the less positive scenario for how I think the relationship could evolve in this time of transition. In order to do that, I'd like to kind of look at the domestic political situations in both our countries, the economic relationship, China as a policy area for how we're going to be working together with Korea as it pertains to China. And then we can't talk about South Korea, certainly in the United States, without mentioning North Korea. So I think that you notice I didn't, North Korea for, and maybe this is too long of time in South Korea, but the South Korean perspective, just as an aside, is that North Korea is not central to the day-to-day. When you look at foreign press talking about Korean Peninsula, North Korea, I imagine, is quite central, quite important to how, you know, Japanese, U.S., European reporters and observers, when they think about Korea, they're thinking about a lot of times about North Korea because of for obvious reasons. It's a threat, a global threat, has nuclear weapons. South Korea, not so much. And this is one of the issues and why North Korea, as a, not as a solve the North Korea problem issue, but as a factor that contributes to how our relationship will evolve is important to look at. And then finally, I'll look at the global Korea, the global posture of Korea, and how when I was in Seoul the last tour, if I think about what I was doing every day, at the core of it, I was trying to pull Korea and the Korean government off the peninsula to make them actualize their pledge and pledges to be more global. And so whether that meant, and they mostly fulfilled that, but that was the real task of the relationship management role that I played, whether it was getting Korea to sign on for export controls, to contribute to the support and defense of Ukraine against the illegal Russian invasion, whether it was to coordinate our aid, COICA is their USAID, foreign aid coordination with Japan, with South Korea, whatever it might be, it was the main task that I felt that I was aiming to do was to pull Korea into these conversations, whether it was at the UN or international organizations or just in a bilateral sense, pulling them off the peninsula. So I think how Korea navigates its global trajectory, I think, is an important factor. And then how we in the United States look to South Korea to partner on how we address global issues is an important factor at how we go forward. So I said I'm again gave away the punchline. I'm pushing for the best case scenario, but I'm going to outline kind of go through those factors and kind of give you an idea of why it might go well and why it could go kind of horribly wrong. And there is potential for that. I think this transition, not just in the governmental sense, not in the sense that I outline, but I think there's a potential for, you know, either Korea to be going all in, and for the United States to be going all in on the relationship, to realize and really partner with Korea on all of the economic and all these factors that I've outlined, to notice that Korea has, and Korea and Koreans and Korean business has become part of the day-to-day. And I think that tipping point that we could achieve would just make management of all any policy difference, I believe, much easier, because you would have a much broader support for the relationship. So how it can go well, you have a new government here, and you have, as I said, in what's happening in South Korea, very briefly, the former president was impeached by the National Assembly. He is currently not in power. He is going through a court process to certify the impeachment or not. Everyone I have spoken, well, almost everyone, except for a few very hardcore supporters of the president, believe, and there's observers, foreign diplomats, reporters, government officials, the list goes on, believe that there will be, the impeachment will be certified. Again, up to the Constitutional Court to make that determination, but for this conversation, we're just going to, so I don't have to conditionalize everything, we're just going to go with the assumption and presumption that there will be a presidential election, because that's what happens once the impeachment is certified. So I believe there'll be an election probably in May. So the best case scenario is that the new president, most likely going to be from the opposition party, that's my assessment, not based on good or bad, but just when you have a conservative president who declares martial law and the whole country says that's a really bad idea, that doesn't set your party up really well for the next election. So that's start there. So the liberal candidate or the next president, whomever that person is, their first job is to get the relationship right with the United States. This is the most important thing that I would remind Washington when there were frictions, when there were rhetorical flourishes, if you will, from the government, from the parliament, about how Korea thought about a particular policy or whatever. And ultimately, Korea's main, their only ally, and this is something that I often had to remind myself of, they have one ally, one, the United States. This is a concept that is, and so I think if you think about that, it makes more sense that Korea is first, second, and third on the priority list, is make sure they get things right with their one ally. Because ultimately, you know, security is the fundamental criteria they have to solve for their people. And the alliance with the United States is, of course, the key part of keeping them safe, of deterring North Korea, of keeping them and their people safe. So, best case scenario, this is seen as job one. They see that a new administration should be accommodated, should be worked with, should find a way to not cause friction. When I worked in Europe at the EU mission, what I saw there, the successful way that I saw management of the relationship with the United States is the EU understood and said this, that the transatlantic relationship was too important to get sidetracked by whatever was happening in Washington. I think this was certainly highlighted during the first Trump administration. I think this is something that the best case scenario, the South Korean government treats the relationship with Washington in the same way. If there are tariffs or there are reductions in incentives or there are barriers to cooperation that perhaps weren't there previously, the South Korea sees the goal being shared prosperity, management of this relationship, and it goes on in a positive sense. The way this works out less well is that Trump or kind of people associated with Trump start from now pushing for some or several of the conservative candidates who, again, I believe are not likely to win, and sets up a confrontational relationship with the likely next president before they become president. My bet on the next president, the liberal candidate, he's a very strong personality, and so I think this could, you know, personalities and relationships do matter, and this could really set things off on a less positive path. The other thing is, because South Korea's only ally, main relationship, main outlet for foreign direct investment, main outlet for studying abroad, for tourism, or maybe after Japan, but main outlet for cultural association and for success, and this is how, you know, if you succeed, you succeed when you are in the United States, working with the United States. So when you have that focus and things don't go quite according to plan, there can be great disappointment. And I think that is a danger. In as this U.S. administration adjusts its Indo-Pacific policy, as it figures out how Korea is going fits into the puzzle, there could be pretty significant disappointment in South Korea with the United States. And it could be even not because of particular policies, but because of lack of diplomatic attention, lack of engagement. So there's various ways where the relationship could just get off on a kind of a rocky start. Things such as the United States and South Korea negotiate every 5 years what's called the Shared Measures Agreement, which is to determine how the deployment of our troops are supported, how that deployment is paid for. It's contentious, but usually the negotiations make the front page for a day or two, a little bit in South Korea. The last administration pushed up the timeline 1 year to get the new agreement done before the election. So there is some danger that the Trump administration says, hey, that's not our deal, we want to renegotiate, and asks for, you know, more money. So these are, again, in the scheme of things, maybe not so significant, but it could lead to, again, this kind of disappointment and disaffectation, which could really set up the relationship for less success. Of course, the second area that I think is, you know, sets things up either in the right way or not as much is the economic relationship. I think the way this goes well is if the conglomerates, they're called the Chaebol, the big Samsung, SK, Hyundai, if they tell the story to the United States about their investment such that the concept of Korea economically, of the Korea-U.S. relationship, is about that investment and not about trade deficit. Right now, there's over $200 billion of trade each year going both ways, but there's a trade deficit of over $50 billion in 2024. This is one of the main reasons is because of the investment. Another reason is because a lot, you know, U.S. Articles are put together in the U.S., but they come back here. It's partly because there's a big deficit, but it's partly because of the nature of the relationship and the big wave of investment that's coming through here, and then the support for those companies that comes along with it. So if the story is of investment, if the story is told by the governors of the states where those 20, 30, 40, in Texas, there's a $30 billion plant just outside of Austin that Samsung is building. You know, it's tens of thousands of jobs. There's billions. SK has pledged over $50 billion over the next number of years, you know, throughout the country. The numbers are pretty staggering, and the job creation that goes along with it is also, it's in the tens of thousands. It's incredibly significant. If that story is told, not by us, but by governors and senators, I do think there's a chance that, you know, that the economic relationship is seen in a positive sense, and it can, you know, set up our cooperation, you know, to be, you know, seen positively by the Trump administration, and to, you know, help manage, tariff conversations, the broader China conversation that South Koreans are quite concerned, probably rightfully so, that they might get caught up in, not because of a particular focus on South Korea, but because that's just the way it works when you're looking at Chinese companies that are assembling things in South Korea, or you're looking at how China and South Korea are working together. Again, they're neighbors. This is part of the economic puzzle. So it comes out poorly if, instead of looking at the investment and looking to leverage South Korean interest in the United States, instead of looking to increase the, you know, this job creation, you know, concept, if instead there is a lot of, you know, again, tariffs is one thing, but more concern to the big companies is how will the incentives that came with legislation from the Biden administration, how will they continue? Will Korean companies that have pledged these billions of dollars of investment over years, and really some of them are profitable on just without the incentives, and so that's great they get incentives, but they're profitable just in a standalone sense. Some of them are not. Some of them are profitable because of the incentive structure that is legislated. So if that is at risk, that could be problematic for the relationship, economic relationship. Otherwise, you saw when the USTR nominee's testimony a few days ago talked about some draft legislation in Korea that could be problematic, basically targeting monopolies on online platforms, both for Google, Netflix, YouTube, you know, but also Korean online platforms like Naver, who have, you know, the vast majority of the search. So there's a legislation regarding platform companies that our government, and this is in the past government as well, thought were damaging to our big companies and how they operate. going along with that, so that could be legislation in South Korea could set up frictions in the relationship. More than that, there is there's a real advantage. This goes both in the best case and worst case scenario. Korea is hosting APEC, a summit this year in Gyeongju in, I think, late October. And one of the big pushes that the South Koreans are making is to make South Korea a hub for regional companies. You know, right now you still have over 1,000 company regional headquarters in Hong Kong. And not because the companies actually think this is a great idea, but because, you know, South Korea is really not, it doesn't really work for them. There's only a handful, or some smallish number, hundreds, but not thousands, where you still have over many, many in Shanghai, certainly many, but the Hong Kong example is quite striking, because you think, oh, people have been moving out of them, Seoul, it would be a logical place to go. And this is part of the conversation at APEC. How can Korea become this hub? For it has seemingly has all the criteria in place. But one of the things that could, in trying to draw this topic out, then what will also could become more the conversation is, well, why is this not a hospitable place for U.S. businesses to work? Why? What are the taxation regulation issues? What are how are you treating foreign businesses? How are you treating foreign CEOs? It's not a, and so again, that's a bigger conversation. But the point is, will the conversation about the economic relationship be focused on that and be full of friction, or will it be focused on how the two countries can do more together? On China, the optimist in me says that Korea has everything, every aptitude to play a key role in helping the United States advance its China policy. Korea is one of the world leaders in shipbuilding. The U.S., I shouldn't say this so near to Bath, but the U.S. does not make many ships, and Korea does. So there's a natural, this is part of the incoming National Security Advisor. He's written about this when he was a lawmaker, about the need, the national security need. This is part of the China conversation, the national security need for the United States to revamp its shipbuilding industry. And the logical way to do that is by partnering with countries like South Korea. But not just shipbuilding, steel. Hyundai has announced a big steel investment, I think, in Louisiana. Because, again, steel in industry is very, very, is one of the world leaders, second largest factories down in southern South Korea. They have, you know, POSCO and a number of other companies that are making, you know, have high technology, highly automated steel industry and factories. They also are still doing mineral extraction, mining companies, but also processing. They have maintained their manufacturing and processing base of, you know, talent base, and this is something that we just have not, for environmental as well as other reasons. Korea is putting out, you know, the engineers and everything. So South Korea is a great partner if you're looking at how we, the United States, could fill in the gap to compete more effectively with China in key areas that are central to our national security. Civil nuclear power. Korea makes, they still are making nuclear power plants. They're making them almost on time and almost on budget, which is not, the United States just is not doing that. Small modular reactors, the South Koreans no one has built those yet, but this is, South Korea, I'm quite certain, will be a leader in this area. They just resolved the U.S., the Westinghouse and KEPCO legal dispute, so now there are fewer impediments to cooperation on civil nuclear writ large, but also for us to work together to bid for future nuclear power plants overseas. And again, I only go on this to make this point that that's a direct, the direct competitor is China and Russia, but China really. So Korea together can help solve some of the problems that are obvious. We, the United States, need to figure out a way to shore up our shipbuilding. We need to figure out how to solve. Conservative estimates suggest that in the next 25 years, there'll be upwards of $1 trillion invested in nuclear power plants, new nuclear power plants. We could, but even if that's, you know, these are big numbers. This is hundreds of reactors, because no one sees a way to solve the electricity demands of the next 25 years without a huge uptick in nuclear power development and generation. And we are, I mean, this is me, the United States government, convinced that China and Russia are not the right answers, whether it's from an economic standpoint or national security standpoint. So this is how Korea can be a partner with us on China. The way it goes less well is particularly in South Korea, they try and emphasize balance. This is a long conversation where Koreans, many say, we look to China for our economic security and the United States for our national security. It's not true, but it doesn't matter. It's a good slogan, and it's good politically, and it helps, you know, it's still alive and kicking. My advice over the years was ignore that and look at the fact that 2/3 of the factories have left from China, mostly to Southeast Asia, over the last 10 years. Look at the fact, the change in foreign direct investment, the fact that they are espousing balance with China, or the current possible next president, the liberal candidate, he's talked about a desire for South Korea to play a role like India, you know, with both, you know, playing both sides. This is a politically potentially very damaging, because it doesn't, it does matter how South Korea positions itself vis-a-vis China, especially in working with a government that we have now in Washington, which is laser focused on China. When I served in the National Security Council, I was in the European Directorate, and the way we work every day is what you're trying to do is bring decisions up through the hierarchy in order to have a decision made about a policy, and then policy is then promulgated. So it's that your role is to bring those, find these issues to discuss and decide about, and bring them up the levels until you get a stamp from the president or equivalent or something like that. If I was covering Turkey, I was covering the UK, I was covering, you know, Greece, Cyprus. If I wanted to discuss something with Turkey, what do you need to bring this up through the policy hierarchy? You need people to come. They show up to the meetings. You need from CIA, DOD, everywhere. They wouldn't show up. You couldn't get a room. You couldn't get the principals of the National Security Council to agree. If it was China and Turkey, if it was China and the UK, off you go. Meeting scheduled. You bring it. It could be, you know, it could be the same policy conversation, but it's how do we work together in order to compete with China? I only say this because this was the simplicity and clarity of the first Trump administration's China approach, I think, was its biggest accomplishment in foreign policy. And you see that it became a bipartisan, pretty much bipartisan consensus that China was a threat and that the government should work to address that. So, again, not suppose that was the reality that I saw, and this is the reality that we're looking at today with, I think, even more, I expect, it hasn't really been rolled out, expect more focus. So again, this is all to say that how South Korea fits into this is it can go very well if they see what Washington's approach is, if they identify what has been pointed out by some of Trump's top advisors, that Korea can fill in some of the areas that the United States lacks in order to compete with China, then I think it'd go well. However, there's a significant danger that instead the conversation is about, you know, South Korea trying to play both sides, or a perception that Korea is not in it on China policy, because they won't say anything about the Uyghurs or about Hong Kong in a policy sense, because they're mindful, even if they are our ally, even if they do agree on most policy areas, they still have to get their 2% economic growth or whatever it might be. And that mostly comes from their global economic posture, but it comes from their relationship with China. And they know from experience that China can turn off the spigot. After one missile defense deployment was put into Korea, I believe in 2016, China turned off its tourism. They just stopped sending tourists. Not an official policy, but that was the result. They stopped having any relations with, I think it's the number 4 or number 5 conglomerate in Korea, because the sin there was that Lotte, the company, they had given the United States and Korea a couple golf courses to put this missile defense deployment on that land. So this is very recent. They understand that I only mention this because it's not an obvious, well, of course they should just come along for the ride on the new China policy. They know what it was from last time. They know that their investment in trade with the United States is central and important. It unfortunately is not that simple for them, because they do rely on China for, they're getting all their inputs from China. I mean, just as we all are, minerals are coming, raw materials are coming from China, processed materials are coming from China. Factories are still, a significant number of them, in China. Sales of companies still going to China. And China is now, interestingly, ramping up their investment into Korea to try and, the same reason they're investing in Mexico, the same reason they're investing in Canada, in order to make Chinese products made in Korea, or made in, just as they're made in Mexico. So North Korea is, I mentioned, as a relationship issue, it could go well in that a new potentially liberal government comes in, and just as the Moon government with Trump last time, they were able to work together. It was rocky. I'm not looking at this without acknowledging that, but they were able to work together to engage with North Korea, and so this could be seen. The liberal government could be seen as an effective partner for engagement. I think the way it goes in general, working with North Korea, the biggest friction between Washington and Seoul, I would say historically, is about how we work together or don't. How independent we look to North Korea, how much we work with China versus how much we work with South Korea in order to manage our relationship with North Korea. It's a tricky needle to thread, because North Korea is, of course, just 20 miles, 30 miles from Seoul. Obviously is a threat to South Korea, but when we are perceiving it as our threat because of the ballistic missiles or the nuclear missiles that North Korea has, there's a tendency for us, the United States, to work in a bilateral fashion. And this is not just Trump 1 or Trump 2, but I think this is an overall concept, policy approach to be managed. So I think that North Korea could play, if there's no engagement, that's probably better for the relationship. The U.S.-South Korea relationship could be moving if that is not an area for us to have to manage. That's where I see it right now, because of North Korea's enhanced relationship with Moscow. But we'll stay tuned on that. Finally, on the global terms, I think that South Korea, as I mentioned, has been aiming to fulfill its global ambitions. It has, for a large part, culturally, economically, geopolitically and geostrategically, I don't think they have. I think they have a lot more to hit at the same level that Samsung does for their country to do that on the world stage. I think that means that they are more engaged in, for example, the conflict between Ukraine and Russia. I think that they, doing more in Southeast Asia, doing more in the Pacific Islands, that is something that I think will come with time. I think that this could be a partnership. It could be a thing that we continue to work on together to make Korea more global and bring them into more conversations about the world and take advantage of their capacity to not only go with, for example, Ukraine is a good example. They could go and not only they could support and supply Ukraine militarily in a way. They're still building weapons that are useful in a more traditional conflict, whereas certainly Europeans and even the United States have for a number of decades focused on more high-tech military capabilities. Legally, it is not legally possible for South Korea to sell military lethal weapons to Ukraine. But again, going forward, do they see a relationship with Ukraine as central to their global role, whether that's in aid or whether that's in trade or whether that's in building factories there to access the European market? The flip side to this potentially more global role is what is the United States, how does the United States look at this role? Does the United States want to partner with South Korea in Southeast Asia or in dealing with other global challenges? So those are the factors that I think are important to look at as we're looking at this important political transition in both our countries, as we're looking into the future, where I think we see there's a tipping point where this, you know, fully, this global economic power and this really very present in America cultural force does it become even more a part of our day-to-day life throughout the entire country? Does South Korea, and does it take advantage of what it has done already in order to set it on a path that is positive one with the United States? I think that the most important factor here is the Korean companies. I think that if they see this as an existential, both possibility and a threat, if they see that if they don't tell their story right to Washington, but also to the rest of America, then this is their only game. This is where they're investing. This is where they're working. This is where their future lies. So if the Korean companies, the Chaebol, see this transition time as the way they saw, you know, the various periods in their economic history where they turned to semiconductors, where they turned to electric vehicles, and where they turned to, you know, they made sure they had capacity to build steel. They made big decisions throughout history, but with the companies, both the companies and the government. Will they see preservation of the relationship with the United States and improvement relationship with the United States as central to their next chapter? And I think if the answer to that question is yes, I'm quite confident that they can tell that story and make sure that we have the United States government looks as Korea as a generator of jobs and not as a generator of a trade deficit. They'll look at Korea as a partner in the China conversation and a partner that and will look for ways to accommodate Korea's geography and reality as part of that partnership. So I'm going to stop there on that optimistic note almost. And I want to just say thanks again for the opportunity to be here, and I look forward to your questions.
Thank you very much, Henry. You've given us an awful lot to talk about. While we collect questions from our members and guests, I always take the opportunity to ask the first question myself. I wonder if you could say a little bit more about how South Korea fits into the overall Asia-Pacific security structure. I know, for example, in this administration, they formed the Quad, which was U.S., Australia, Japan, and India. The ROK is missing from that. Where do they fit into how the U.S. sees security structure in Asia?
That's a great question. Specifically on the Quad, South Korea participates in several of the pillars of the Quad. They attend meetings, they're participating, but they're not a member. Similarly, AUKUS, they participate in some meetings. This is Australia, UK, United States. They're very interested in being partners with on this. But the real answer is their focus that I talked about on Washington means that they're less engaged on these minilateral, plurilateral projects. Also, for example, G7, not specific to your answer of the Indo-Pacific, but this is another area where Korea is interested in engaging. Japan, you know, is maybe less so. Japan maybe less so with the Quad as well. So they fit in really via Washington.
All right, thank you. Here's a question that I had myself, so I pulled it out first. How are the relations between South Korea and Japan? Are they economically intertwined? I know that historically they're enemies, but...
So they are. Their economies are quite intertwined. Japan, most of the big Korean companies were started with Japanese investment, Japanese technology. This is in the 50s, 60s, 70s. The trade volume is quite high. Investment is quite high. Tourism. Now the Koreans with the yen, they go to Japan. So they're very interlinked. Some of the largest conglomerates are based both in Japan and South Korea. So I think just I would take one note on saying enemies. They are. I think frenemies might be more accurate. They are in alliances. Japan is in alliance with the United States. Korea is in alliance with the United States. They are not, you know, in any policy sense at war, you know, at odds with each other. They're overlapping through the Venn diagram of policies is through us. So I think they are challenged in how they work together, but economically they're interlinked. And in their policy approach to the world, they have an incredible amount of overlap.
Seems like the relationship's gotten better recently. Is that a mirage or is that?
No, there has been a big move forward with the deposed President Yoon made it central to his approach was to improve the bilateral relationship with Japan and also. We supported that through trilateral engagement. It remains to be seen how the bilateral relationship is managed between South Korea and Japan in the next South Korean administration.
Then how about Taiwan? Is the relationship between Korea and Taiwan?
So it is not very, is not significant. South Korea is sensitive to China in all ways, certainly geostrategically. When Nancy Pelosi, as Speaker, went to Taiwan in the summer of 2022, after that she came to South Korea, and there was such sensitivity about her visit that the meetings in South Korea were quite difficult. In every conceivable way. So this is just to say that it goes down to protocol level, that the relationship with Taiwan is seen as, I'm not sure, I'm sure the South Korean government would not say this, but this is my characterization, is that they are willing to sacrifice a strong relationship with Taiwan in order to maintain that economic relationship that I spoke about with China.
And then with the both Taiwan and Japan, if the U.S. were to pull back as the kind of the lead on these things, would that have a lot of effect on Korea and the way they deal with the other powers in the region?
If the United States pulled back from Taiwan or South Korea or Japan, just right. Generally from
yes.
The region? For sure, the United States, as I mentioned, particularly with Japan and Korea, you know, by having that trilateral defense arrangement and defense conversations, meetings we've had for decades, we've been working trilaterally to keep things going, you know, in a positive direction between Japan and Korea, because we're convinced that this is they play they're the those alliances are central to regional security and stability. So if the United States, I try not to do too many hypotheticals, but if they were to withdraw, this would be, I think that South Korea and Japan would have the interconnections and the policy history of policy coordination and overlap. I think they would manage, but I don't think that's likely to happen, because I think that in any China conversation, in any conversation about the Indo-Pacific, the United States has and will continue to turn to our key allies, Japan and Korea. So could it shift? Could our relationship with them shift? Of course, but I think that I'm relatively hopeful that the bilateral could muddle its way along without us.
So now if Trump were to impose significant tariffs on North Korea, how is that going to, what overall effect is that going to have in the long run? I mean, is it going to be, you know, is it really going to shift the trade balance and or not?
So tariffs on South Korea?
South Korea.
Okay.
Yes.
The North Korea question is much easier. Can I take that one?
No. Been tariffs, sanctions on them for a while.
Those tough tariffs on North Korea, they will make a difference. the tariffs on South Korea, this is, as I said, in it could be very challenging. It could really put a wrench in the works. It could, this administration, the officials that are in place, the Deputy National Security Advisor worked as a North Korea, on Korea in the last administration. You know, a lot of the key officials have real Korea experience. I think I'm confident they understand the centrality of the relationship to the China equation, but I also think that I think the way it could go is they say, well, we understand Korea and we're going to be able to find a way to manage those bumps in the road, that it's in service of the China conversation. So would tariffs be damaging? Yes. I mean, I think it really could change. Worst case scenario is we push Korea towards kind of rethinking its singular focus on the United States.
And it kind of related to this whole overall trade question. Someone's asking what effect the current the executive orders that Trump has already signed, like withdrawing money from green projects and all, what effect does that have on the South Korean investment in the U.S.? Was that heavily dependent on those? You made some comments in your talk about that, but if you'd expand a little bit.
I mean, I think up till now, I think I'll go the remains to be seen route, but because I think the executive orders, I think, and the reason I say that is because the real money and potential and possibility for the South Korean companies is legislative. So what will the legislative changes be? If there are legislative changes or there's a change in how the benefits are being allocated, which I believe is possible without legislative change, then that could change the way South Koreans either propose new investments or even to adjust the investments that they've already announced, both Korean and U.S.
Should South Korea get nuclear weapons, or is there a lot of pressure internally in South Korea? I actually had several questions related to nuclear weapons.
That's a very lively debate that's ongoing in South Korea for a number of reasons. First and foremost, North Korea has nuclear weapons, so they think, well, why? If they're just asked, hey, you know, North Korea has them, why shouldn't we? You know, most people say, oh, that sounds pretty good. And they say, sure, we support that. They say, well, if you had nuclear weapons, you would then have to withdraw from this treaty and you could be subject to these, you know, sanctions, or could be these problems, or could upset the relationship. The support for the nuclear weapons goes way, way down. Also, if you talk to people like, well, what would the use? I mean, they understand that it could be a deterrent, but I don't think people really think that having nuclear weapons, or many people think that would actually make them particularly safer. But the people who do think it's either why not, what about North Korea, or they think the extended deterrence, the treaty alliance that the South Korea has with the United States, what happens if that is becomes less solid, then would we need to have a deterrent of our own? So this is an ongoing conversation. I think that right now we're doing a lot, the U.S. government, to reassure South Korean government and its people that that deterrent, extended deterrent, still remains in place. The alliance is solid, but the conversation is certainly a live one.
And finally, let me ask one more here. I have quite a few more questions here, and I apologize to people for not getting to them, but several people wanted to know, given what Trump did during his first term toward Korea in terms of demanding that they pay for more of the cost of U.S. troops and cutting off the joint exercises, et cetera, what's the likelihood that Trump would pull the troops, our troops, from South Korea this time, and what would happen if that happened?
So I know this is something that the South Koreans are certainly concerned about, and certainly was talked about during the campaign, and I think Trump himself has said this at various times. So is it possible? Technically, sure. Practically, very difficult. There is bipartisan support for this presence. I think that if, as the only U.S. troops on the Asian mainland, as a deterrent to China, I think if I would suspect that anyone on his staff would explain that this is in our interest to be deployed there. So I don't think it is likely. I think it is technically possible. There has been legislation put in place in order to make it less possible. So that's one more hurdle in place. It could be reduced presence, fewer rotations, smaller exercises. These are all things that I think are possible.
Well, thank you very, very much. It's been very interesting.